Today's broadcast was originally recorded on December 10th, 2025.
Well, you know what? We have 3 years and 2 months to go. And you know what that is in Trump time? 3 years and 2 months is called eternity.
No frickin' kidding, dude.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
But we can do something about
it. I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Says me.
Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, elsewhere in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon, on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans, on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico, on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. So the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. And I will say it is a thrilling edition. I will tell you what. If Democrats do not field a candidate for every frickin' race in every frickin' contest on every frickin' ballot in the country next November, they are out of their frickin' minds, to be frank. Hi, Desi.
Hi.
How are you? That's Desi Doyen. She's our producer.
I would agree with that sentiment.
Because based on elections that we are seeing this year, including last night, in deep red areas of Florida and Georgia and more, I would suggest that every seat, no matter how red it supposedly is, may very well be up for grabs by the time we get to next year's midterm elections, especially with a president still in office who correctly characterizes the next 3 years and 2 months of Trump time as an eternity. It certainly is. And it's an eternity for voters just until, you know, next November, when everyone in the country can ring in on what they think about that eternity currently underway. And not just in the U.S. House or in the Senate. I am talking about every frickin' state, city, and local race across the country. Democrats need to put someone up. There should be no races where there's only a Republican running. You got a deeply entrenched, longtime incumbent Republican commissioner of guns, Bibles, and country music in Robert E. Lee County, Alabama? Well, Democrats need to be putting someone up to challenge that guy next year because they could very well win it. I don't know if there is a Robert E. Lee County in Alabama. I don't think there's a Republican commissioner of guns, Bibles, and country music, but there might as well be. And if there is, well, Democrats ought to fight for that seat. Yeah, we had a few more elections on Tuesday this week on the heels of special elections around the country earlier this year where support shifted towards the Democratic candidate in every single race by an average of about 13 points. And then the November 4th blue wave off-year elections last month, where Democrats won in state after state after state in Virginia, New Jersey, New York City, and even in states like Georgia and Mississippi. And then last week's special election for the U.S. House down in GOP gerrymandered Tennessee, in a district where Trump had won by 22 points last year, but where Democrats overperformed yet again. While they did not win that vacant U.S. House seat, voters went for the very progressive Democratic candidate by about, yes, 13 points more than they voted for Kamala Harris in the presidential race last year. Well, yes, it happened again on Tuesday this week in several states, beginning perhaps most notably the one you may have heard about in Trump's own backyard down in Florida, about an hour's drive from Mar-a-Lago in Miami. Former Miami-Dade County Commissioner Eileen Higgins won Miami's mayoral runoff election on Tuesday, marking the first time ever that a woman will hold that job and the first time in nearly 30 years that the city, which has been moving sort of farther and farther to the right over the past decade or more, the first time in nearly 30 years that Miami has elected a Democrat as mayor. I wonder why. She won. Not only did she just, you know, eke out a victory here, she won by almost 20 points.
I think we call that a blowout.
Higgins secured 59% of the vote versus former Miami City Manager Amelia Gonzalez's nearly 41%, according to still unofficial results from the Miami-Dade County Supervisor of Elections. So essentially a 60-40 landslide. The win, if certified as expected, marks an end to a competitive race that actually began with a crowded 13-person field earlier this year. Quote, "Our city chose a new direction," Higgins told the cheering crowd at her election night celebration on Tuesday. "You can choose competence over chaos, results over excuses, and a city government that finally works for you," she said. The campaign centered on issues like immigration, housing, and flooding, an important climate change-fueled topic down in South Florida.
Oh my, yes, and getting much more salient.
And an issue that, frankly, guys like Trump, love to ignore those topics, or actually make worse. Those were just some of the issues of note in that race. But while the race was officially nonpartisan, no race is actually nonpartisan these days, it seems. Higgins had been backed by prominent Democrats, while Republicans, including Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida and President Trump, had endorsed Gonzalez. A lot of good that did for him. Neither Trump nor DeSantis's endorsement was enough. In fact, given the unpopularity of Donald Trump right now, it probably hurt Gonzalez and helped Higgins that Trump endorsed Gonzalez in Miami. Higgins served 8 years on the Miami-Dade County Commission and campaigned on restoring public trust and bringing what she described as calmer, more collaborative leadership to City Hall. Well, there's an idea. Affordable housing was a cornerstone of her platform. Uh-oh, there's that word affordability again, which Donald Trump told supporters once again on Tuesday night during a rally at a casino in Pennsylvania, even as results were being tallied up down in Florida last night. That affordability, that's just a Democrat hoax, as he likes to describe it. Higgins pledged to utilize city-owned land to build more housing for working families. She criticized Miami's rapid growth without corresponding improvements in city services. On immigration enforcement, Higgins voiced strong concerns, calling recent actions in Miami, quote, inhumane and cruel. Voters in Miami appeared to have agreed with her by a lot. Higgins vowed to work with the Trump administration on issues where they can find common ground, but she told CBS News, quote, "When we disagree, I will make my voice heard." At her victory rally, when she took the stage, she told cheering supporters, among other things, quote, "We will confront the affordability crisis with the urgency that Miami families need. We will lead a city that belongs to everyone, she said, a city where seniors can stay, younger people can build a future, immigrants feel welcomed and respected, she added, as the crowd roared again. Prominent Miami figures joined Higgins at the celebration, including county officials, the Miami police chief, as well as the Florida Democratic Party chair, Nikki Fried, underscoring the historic nature of Higgins' win. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava congratulated Higgins, calling the win a milestone for representation, and said the voters sent a clear message that they are tired of chaos and corruption. And yes, rising costs, saying, quote, for nearly 130 years since Julia Tuttle founded this city, Levine-Cava said, Miami has never elected a woman as mayor. That changes tonight. Higgins was asked by CBS News' Major Garrett about the Trump effect on this race. She said, well, I don't really know about that, but
I have a track record of serving for 8 years on the county commission in this city where I represent a Republican-leaning district. The folks in the city of Miami know that I am a loud, proud Democrat. But when I get elected, the election's over, and the time of service begins, and you serve everybody. Never, ever ask their political affiliation if their street is flooded, if they need an affordable unit to live in. You don't ask what party they're from. You say, yep, we got to figure out how to make that happen for you.
Wow, there's an idea. You get elected and you serve everyone. Even if they didn't vote for you, madam? Yeah, apparently so. Good for her. Higgins win, according to CBS Miami. Signals a shift in the political landscape in the city and sets the stage for significant policy changes in the years ahead regarding affordability, climate resilience, and government transparency. Basically, all the stuff that voters around the country seem to be demanding right now pretty much everywhere. And it wasn't only in Miami, where Democrats exceeded expectations on Tuesday. There were also two special elections to fill vacancies in the Florida State House on Tuesday. One seat previously held by a Republican will be held by a Republican again. And the other seat previously held by a Democrat will also be held by a Democrat again. But the shift in the margins towards the Democratic candidate in both cases, well, it was quite notable for those of us paying attention to what all of these elections are likely to mean during next year's critical midterm elections across the entire country. In the race won by the Republican, Democrats overperformed by 10 points as compared to the same district last year. And in the race for the seat held by a Democrat, that vote shifted 15 points in favor of the Democratic candidate compared to last year. And it was not only in Florida on Tuesday night. As CNN reported it, Democrats continued their run of success in special elections by flipping a state House seat in Georgia on Tuesday, my favorite state. The Democratic victory, they write, in a district that voted for President Donald Trump by more than 12 points last year, comes ahead of next year's critical midterms when Georgians will vote in closely watched races for Senate and governor across the state, not to mention a whole bunch of U.S. House seats and much more. Eric Geisler, a Democrat who owns a local olive oil store, appears to have defeated Republican Mac Dutch Guest in the 121st House District in Georgia, in the northern part of the state near the college town of Athens. Now, it was a very close race with Geisler, appearing to have won, according to Georgia Secretary of State, as of last check, by just under 2 points, or in this case, by about 200 votes as of late last night. So a seemingly very close race, a 2-point race, flipping that seat from Republican to Democrat, but that victory by Geisler, that's about a 14 or 15 point shift toward the Democrat as compared to last year in that very same district. I wonder what happened between last year and this year. to make this district in Georgia shift about 14 or 15 points towards the Democrat. As CNN summarizes state legislative elections elsewhere in recent weeks and months, they note in summarizing those that between regularly scheduled elections in Virginia and New Jersey and special elections held on newly redrawn maps in Mississippi, Democrats flipped about 20 state legislative seats on Election Day last month alone. Those victories came after Democrats flipped two seats in Iowa and one in Pennsylvania during special elections earlier in the year. Republicans, they note, still control a significant majority in the Georgia House, but Tuesday's results come just a month after Democrats won two statewide elections in Georgia to flip two seats on the state's important public service commission, which sets electricity rates and so forth. Those were the only contests on the ballot in most of the state on November 4th. Democrats won both of them on a public service commission, which had only had Republicans on it for years and years and years.
Making sure that rates were going up and up and up.
Until last month,
yep.
When two Democrats finally won. Georgia Democrats, this was, quote, a big win for Georgia Democrats, according to the Democratic Party of Georgia, who congratulated Geisler in a statement on Tuesday evening, noting it's a win for every family in Oconee and Clark counties who have been struggling to get ahead under 22 years of what they describe as failed Republican leadership. That changed on Tuesday. Quote, all across the state, Georgians are realizing there's only one party that's working to lower costs, keep health care affordable, and put people ahead of big corporations, and that's the Democratic Party, said the state Democratic Party chair, Charlie Bailey. In a statement adding, our momentum is only growing and we will continue outworking, out-organizing, and out-strategizing Republicans to turn it into more wins for the people of Georgia in 2026. We will see. In the great city of Albuquerque, New Mexico, one of my favorite cities actually in the nation. I know a bunch of listeners there who probably already know this, but voters on Tuesday re-elected Tim Keller for an historic third consecutive term as Albuquerque mayor in a runoff contest. Though the mayoral race in the city is officially nonpartisan, again, everyone knows who is supported by the Democrats and who is supported by the Republicans. And yes, they voted for the Democrat here for the third time. No previous Albuquerque mayor has ever served for three consecutive terms until now. There are no term limits for Albuquerque mayors, but only Keller has run for and won three times in a row. There was apparently another mayor who also served for three times, but it was not consecutive terms. Mayor Keller secured what the local outlet KRQE is describing as a, quote, sweeping victory on Tuesday night, with Keller noting, quote, the city has spoken, and folks have essentially said one thing loud and clear. They want us to keep going. In his victory night remarks, he told supporters, quote, we are not going to allow ICE in. We are not going to let Trump come into Albuquerque. It's a mandate to push forward, and it's also a challenge to rise to the occasion. That's what our next 4 years are going to be about, said Keller. Election watcher Daniel Nishanian of Bolts magazine also notes that the liberal faction in Albuquerque flipped the city council on Tuesday night. And if you haven't noticed, all three of these victories for Democrats come in three presidential battleground states: in Florida, in Georgia, in New Mexico, which I am quite sure only adds to the anxiety of Republicans right now. Republicans, particularly in the U.S. House, gosh, we hate to add to their anxiety. This particularly is Florida is the state of Florida is considering re-gerrymandering their already gerrymandered U.S. House map very soon in response to Trump's orders for GOP states to do so. But if elections this year are swinging from, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 points towards Democrats, are Florida Republicans really sure that they want to make some of their safe U.S. House seats, previously at least previously considered to be very safe Republican seats, are they sure they want to make those seats a little bit less safe in order to try to steal Democratic seats from state voters in next year's midterm elections? I mean, go for it, guys. But, you know, good luck with that. You got a district you think is a safe district because the Republican won it last year by 15 points. And, let's change it to take some of those Democrats from these blue districts and put them into the, you know, and now maybe they'll still win by 13 points. Really? Are they going to win by 13 points if the electorate shifts by 13 points next year? So all of that may come back to bite the Republicans next year. We will see in Florida, in Texas, in North Carolina, maybe in Indiana, where the state house has now adopted a map to try and disappear the only two remaining blue U.S. House districts left in the Hoosier state, but where Republicans in the state Senate, meantime, may not be quite so eager to do the same. We will see. If that map that was passed by the state house there actually gets through the Senate. And in Missouri, where Republicans there have already voted to gerrymander one of two blue districts out of existence next year, the one in Kansas City, or at least they are trying to. They have tried to do that. But we spoke on this program some weeks ago with the head of the People Not Politics organization in my great old home state of Missouri, where they had been gathering signatures in response to all this, gathering petition signatures in order to challenge those that new state U.S. House map that was adopted as HB1 in Missouri a few months ago now. The group's leader, Richard Von Glahn, joined us on the program at the time to explain that he was quite confident that his group would be able to gather enough signatures to challenge HB1 on next year's ballot come November. And if they are able to do so, if they are able to get enough ballot enough signatures to get this referendum on the ballot, well, if that happens, HB1 would go on hold until it is either adopted or rejected by voters at the ballot box next year. So that one seat that Republicans hope to steal from Kansas City, from Democratic voters in Kansas City, that map will go on hold, or at least it's supposed to, if this group gathers enough signatures. Well, this week, the group got in touch with me to let me know that, yes, they have indeed now gathered the needed signatures to put that GOP gerrymander on hold to leave it up to the voters next year to decide what to do next November.
So to make sure I understand this, so if they get enough signatures, then the whole HB1 law is on hold until voters can vote on it.
Exactly.
Good.
That if they get enough signatures, right. And now they contacted me on Tuesday to say, today Missourians delivered over 300,000 signatures.
Wow.
Which they called three times what was required. And that's sort of what Richard Von Glahn had said when he was on the show. He was like, yeah, we're going to have plenty. Don't worry about it. We already got plenty more. So three times what was reported in order to force a referendum, a voter referendum on HB1, the legislature's new super gerrymandered congressional map, as they described it. Under the Missouri Constitution, once those signatures are submitted, the map cannot take effect unless voters approve it. But, they write, state officials are now signaling, Republican officials, are now signaling that they may ignore that constitutional requirement and attempt to implement the map anyway. If they proceed, they tell me, Missouri would be testing whether a state government can override its own direct democracy protections to entrench its power. This, they write, is no longer just a redistricting fight. It's a live test of whether citizen-led referendums still function as a guardrail in American democracy. Missouri may be about to provide the clearest example yet of a state considering the nullification of its own constitutional check on legislative power, they warn. So, we will, of course, be keeping our eyes on that. The group tells me that they are ready to go to court if need be, where there is, by the way, already a separate challenge that was previously filed to HB1, the state's mid-decade gerrymander. So that fight continues, but it is, at least for the moment, looking good for voters in the Show Me State. As noted, Democrats, well, they did really well on Tuesday, but they did not win everything everywhere, though they appear to have overperformed just about everywhere, including on Tuesday in deep red Iowa. Republican Wendy Larson won a special election to hold a seat previously held by a Republican in Northwest Iowa's House District 7. Retaining House Republican supermajority in the state legislature. It was, in fact, a landslide for the Republican, with Larson winning about 70% of the vote over the Democratic candidate, Rachel Burns. She received just 30%, according to unofficial results from the Iowa Secretary of State's office. And with Larson's 40-point win, Republicans retain, for now, their 67 supermajority in the Iowa House. But even here, in a 70-30 race, even here, Democrats overperformed by 11 points as compared to last year, noted the Iowa Democratic Party chair, Rita Hart, who said that the challenge from the Democrat Burns, quote, forced Republicans to spend over $35,000 in a district that Donald Trump last year won by 52 points. So, yeah, Democrats lost, but they picked up 11 points. They forced the Republicans to spend money defending a seat that they shouldn't have had to have spent anything defending, a seat that Donald Trump won by 52 points last year. According to the Des Moines Register, Larson's win on Tuesday marks the fifth special election for the Iowa legislature in 2025, where, by the way, for some reason, a bunch of incumbents actually died recently for all sorts of reasons, Republican and Democrats, leading to all of these special elections. Not all of them, but many of them, because of the incumbent died. Otherwise, some of them left to take another position in government, etc. In January, a Democrat pulled off a surprise victory over a Republican in the Eastern Iowa Senate seat. Republicans narrowly held another House seat. I think in that same election in April, a Democrat won to hold another House seat that was vacated by a Democrat. And in August, Democrat Caitlin Dre won a special election for the Iowa Senate, in that case flipping a seat that was previously held by a Republican, and in the bargain of doing so, breaking Senate Republicans' supermajority in Iowa in the 50-member chamber there. And in each of those five special legislative elections in Iowa this year, yes, again, Democrats overperformed anywhere from 9 points to 15 points as compared to the presidential race in each of those districts over the past year. There will be one final election this year in Iowa, in Polk County, to fill a seat that was vacated again by the death of another state Senate Democrat in this case. And in every state legislative special election in Iowa this year, support has shifted in favor of Democrats, anywhere from 9 to 15 points. Do that math for next year. In the U.S. House elections, where Republicans currently They hold currently about they will hold a two-vote advantage, I believe it is, beginning in January after Marjorie Taylor Greene leaves. And where in the U.S. House, as I noted last week, I believe there are currently 77 sitting Republicans who won their race last year by 13 points or less. 77 seats. So again, if the entire electorate shifts 13 points next year, well, it would be a rout in the U.S. House in favor of Democrats. Daniel Nishanian rounds up some of the 2025 math for us today over at the Great Bolts magazine. He notes that at the start of Donald Trump's first presidency back in 2017, large Democratic victories in New Jersey and Virginia, paired with overperformances in special elections for Democrats, foreshadowed the blue wave elections of the 2018 midterms. 8 years later, he notes, Trump's return to power has been followed by similar Republican setbacks, including Democrats' sweep of all 13 statewide elections that have taken place, that took place this November. Plus, he notes, myriad gains for local offices. Now, with this year's contest nearly all completed after Tuesday, which saw Democrats stage an upset and flip a state House seat in Georgia, the extent to which the GOP struggled in legislative races has also now come into clearer view. Democrats, buoyed by Trump's unpopularity and a fired-up base, flipped 21% of all GOP-held seats that were on the ballot throughout 2025, 21%, which is a lot. According to Bolt's analysis, Democrats gained 25 state, Senate, and House seats that were held by the GOP previously out of the 118 elections that were resolved this year in either regular or special elections. That swing, he notes, is even stronger than back in 2017 in advance of that 2018 blue wave election. Among their 2025 gains, he says, Democrats have secured their largest majority in the Virginia House since the 1980s. They expanded their control of the New Jersey State Assembly and they have broken Republican supermajorities in the state senates of Iowa and Mississippi. They also flipped a state senate seat in a deeply Republican region of Pennsylvania and staged Tuesday's upset in that Georgia district that Trump had carried by double digits last year. Meanwhile, Republicans failed to flip any legislative seats this entire year. Zero. They flipped zero of them.
Zero. Wow.
They lost ground even in New Jersey, where they had high hopes, and they failed to gain several districts in New York State that Trump had carried last year. In 2017, the GOP did manage to flip a handful of seats, but not this year. This year, they have flipped, let me do the math again, zero. They flipped zero. And notes Nishanian, the GOP may have actually gotten lucky this year because most of the legislative elections that occurred in 2025 were actually for seats that Democrats had already held, which limited their opportunity for flips, for gains. Bolts reports that in an analysis of the last 3 years, there has been no comparable swing for either party as compared to what we have seen in 2025. Thousands of legislative seats plus 36 governorships will be on the ballot during the next year's midterm elections. At least on paper, he notes, partisan control of virtually every state government could shift, with about a dozen states now that are already looking like battlegrounds for both parties hoping to break up or gain governmental trifectas, including in Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Iowa, New Hampshire, Ohio, Kansas, Maine, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And that doesn't even get us down to the county level, like, you know, Robert E. Lee County down in Alabama, where they're flipping the commissioner of country music. Now, as I always try to remind you, results that are reported the day after elections, well, they are unofficial results, and that problems with the tallying and so forth, they often don't show up if they exist. They sometimes are not noticed for days or weeks after election day. And I know it probably drives you all nuts when I point that out. It's like, yeah, whatever. Well, guess what? We got one of those stories for you today. That's coming up next. A problem discovered weeks after Election Day, after last month's off-year general elections in early November. And we also have Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report,
Yay!
Which was preempted yesterday thanks to my interview with Nobel Peace Prize winning climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann, which, by the way, you can download for free via bradblog.com. If you did not catch it yesterday, I highly recommend it, but of course I do. And maybe we'll have some other stuff. We will see, depending on how things go. So we will be right back after a quick break. I am Brad, and you are listening to the listener-funded Thanks, Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
You can count on me like 1, 2, 3, I'll be there. And I know when I need it, I can count on you.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi's Green News Report coming up, I promise, shortly. And by the way, we're out here in Los Angeles, as you know, in Southern California. It is hot.
Yes.
Out here, I hate to say it because I know it's getting cooler around the rest of the country, but we are in the 80s out here.
Yeah.
And I know if you live elsewhere, that probably sounds fantastic, but
it's not, actually. It's quite unusual, and it means that the vegetation is drying out, and it's just really weird.
In November.
In December.
December.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, 80s in December.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to worry about. Anyway, we'll get to Green News Report in a bit. As mentioned, we always try to warn when we're reporting on election results the day after an election that all of the results we're working from are unofficial. They almost always are based on nothing more than computer tallies, sometimes just partial computer tallies. And almost none of those ballots are actually examined by any human being at the time of those unofficial reports on election night and into the next day and even into the following days. Most of those votes are never examined by human beings. Though in some cases, some jurisdictions will do a hand examination of a small portion of ballots as part of a post-election canvas or an audit of varying types. Sometimes some of them will run it back through the optical scanners, some of them again to try and audit. But, you know, we always try to warn that those unofficial numbers reported the day after election could change if there are any problems found in those computer tallies, and that sometimes it will take days or weeks or even months before such problems are actually discovered and come to light. Welp, guess what? Looks like we've got one of those problems today. We always promise to keep our eyes on, on any such problems in the days ahead. Well, here we have one emerging now. This follows last month's November 4 off-year election, so that's more than a month ago now, in a small town in Rensselaer County in upstate New York, where most voters cast hand-marked paper ballots, thankfully, that are then tabulated by computerized scanners made by a company called ClearVote, which is not one of the major companies that you've likely heard of, like ESNS and Dominion, which is now a company actually called Liberty, or even the nation's third largest voting system vendor called Hart InterCivic. Clear Ballot is a relatively new, small, independent company, and it looks like their systems were first deployed in Rensselaer County back in, just last year, in 2024. But something seems to have gone wildly wrong with those systems last month, according to reporting today from the Times Union up in Albany, New York. Unofficial results after Election Day a month ago showed that the budget proposal for the tiny Steventown Memorial Library in the tiny upstate rural village of Steventown, New York. It's right near the Massachusetts border. That budget was shot down by 89% of voters, or in this case, a vote of 528-60. As it turns out, however, that count was wildly inaccurate, notes the Times Union. Certified election results submitted by the Rensselaer County Board of Elections following a recount showed that the library's proposal to increase municipal tax contributions from $95,000 to $110,000, so giving themselves a $15,000 raise, actually that measure passed. And it passed easily by voters, by a vote of 540-279. Those results were filed Monday with the State Board of Elections after a manual hand recount. So the tax referendum did not actually lose 528-60. It actually won 540-279. The originally reported numbers were not even close. The entire race was backwards. The certification of the new numbers, following what I believe was a hand count, marks the end of what the Times Union describes as a shocking chapter for the rural library located less than 3 miles from the Massachusetts border. The initial results had been met at the time with disbelief among library stakeholders. Library Board President Jennifer Peabody told the paper, quote, "As I've said before, it's an uncomfortable position for us to question the results of an election, but we knew that the numbers just did not make sense." She said, "So we are glad to see that with our suspicions, there was something behind that." And yeah, I'm glad that they weren't so afraid of, you know, being tarred as conspiracy theorists for, you know, simply asking to, hey, let's count these ballots, let's make sure they're accurate, that they were willing to speak up in the first place.
Well, and also, they probably aren't a lot of hair on fire conspiracy theorists. So, you know, just saying, hey, let's recount this carefully and calmly.
But we're in a position where, you know, people are made to feel like, you know, jerks for asking that their ballots be counted, that that there be some public oversight of our elections so that we don't just, you know, put all of our trust into computers.
Absolutely.
For the record, a tiny Steventown and Rensselaer County, where it's located, is actually a bit of a political battleground. It's fairly evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, going back and forth over the past several presidential elections. But because this library funding matter was a ballot issue, I think, as opposed to a partisan race for candidates, I think it was probably a little bit easier to challenge the results, although they actually had to, you know, work to get this hand count. Peabody, the library president and supporters of the institution pushed. They had to push for a recount right after the election, but that request was not entertained until county election officials actually discovered that some results from a separate state referendum that was on the ballot that had been printed on the back of the ballot, that in fact could have been impacted by ovals improperly juxtaposed over text, as the paper reports it. Okay, what does that mean? I've been speaking to a number of voting system experts today about this, trying to make sense of this report in the Times Union, which doesn't actually offer a lot of details about what appears to have gone wrong here. But one, well, it means that the library had a tough time getting a recount, even though numbers from the election night were clearly off as they saw it. Two, it wasn't until local county officials noticed that some statewide election numbers might have been affected here before they took any action. And three, as to this matter of another race on the backside of the ballot being impacted by ovals on the front of the ballot, juxtaposing text or however they described it, well, when there are two-sided ballots, the races that are on each side of that piece of paper are supposed to be on different lines. So in other words, like if you hold it up to the light, the races don't overlap each other. They're on separate lines on the backside and the front side. So if the paper is too lightweight, or the pen that was used by a voter to mark the ovals on the other side of the ballot, if it's too heavy and if it bleeds through, well, that mark that bleed through would be ignored by the scanner on that side when the computer scanner is counting the ballot. It won't get, you know, it won't throw off the count in the other race on the other side of the ballot because it's not on the same line where the computer scanner is supposed to be looking, is expecting to find a vote in that particular race, if that makes sense. As UC Berkeley voting system expert Philip Stark told me when I asked him about this, and I said, you know, hey, aren't they supposed to be on different lines on the back side of the ballot so they don't accidentally conflict with the front side? He quipped back in response via email, yep, it never happens, except when it does. The local Board of Elections finally launched a countywide recount for the November 4 elections on November 20. So weeks later, the county election commissioners, there are both Republican and Democratic commissioners on the board. They declined to give comment about all of this to the Times Union. But some election integrity colleagues of mine are attempting to try to get some more documents under New York's Freedom of Information law to try and learn what may have happened. But it turns out it was not only the library on the ballot that was affected. While not specifying how the results had changed, the paper notes, Republican Election Commissioner Henry Zwack acknowledged that the recount also shifted totals for a proposal to end a volunteer service program for East Greenbush's rescue squad and a state estate proposition to develop state forest land up in North Elba, up in the Adirondack Mountains. So get this, the East Greenbush rescue squad proposal, the proposal to end it, well, it shifted from a 517 to 505 vote passage to end the squad. It shifted from that to a 2,381 to 2,250 defeat in order to keep the rescue squad going. It was not even close. The state's proposal, the state proposals for the Rensselaer County approval tally for the Adirondack Mountains, that didn't shift all that much. But between the library and the rescue squad, those flipped entirely. No other results were said to have been affected by the recount. The official Steventown Memorial Library results far surpassed the 240 vote affirmation forms that were collected by the library. It seems like they went door to door. They got signatures from 240 people that proved that there were more than 60 people who, you know, voted in favor of funding the library. So that's what they had to do in order to get a recount. In fact, it was going to be a machine count until the county found problems with the machine count. And they said, you know what, we better do a manual hand count, which they did. Which, thankfully, unless we have hand-marked paper ballots, as we did have here, thankfully, and unless at least there is a minimum sum of those votes that are hand-counted, well, we can never know for sure if our election results are being reported and recorded accurately. And this race, well, this election proves that again. So kudos to the Steventown Memorial Library folks for fighting for this recount. which they shouldn't have had to do in the first place, if you ask me. And it sounds like they also had to fight for that, you know, just to get a manual hand count. A lot of these places will only do an electric scan if they are forced to do a recount at all. It doesn't work, democracy, unless you fight for it to work. The library president said, I think this was a huge undertaking for them to do a recount of everything, but I think it was important to restore people's faith in the integrity of the elections, and that process worked. But again, it does not work unless you fight for it to work. And by the way, faith has nothing to do with it. Restoring confidence that the system works can only happen if the public is allowed to oversee their own elections, which is always critical and is what happened here. Had the measure failed, operating hours for the library would have likely been cut, Peabody said, but it didn't fail. And thanks to the folks fighting to make sure that their ballots were counted as cast in tiny Steventown, New York, the library will stay open. It's a Christmas miracle, except it isn't. It's public oversight, overseeing their own democracy. That is our job, but we can only do it if we have hand-marked paper ballots that ultimately, if we're allowed to count them, can tell us how people actually voted in our elections. And with that, it's our latest Green News Report.
Iran is facing its worst water crisis in decades.
It's not just Iran. New study warns that climate impacts are accelerating across the volatile Middle East. Congressional Republicans give another big gift to big oil in Alaska. Plus, feud between MAGA and MAHA grows over Trump EPA's rollbacks on toxic chemicals.
Let the Civil War begin. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
There has been a story going around in the news the last couple of days, and frankly, we've been hesitant to touch it. But it feels irresponsible to stay silent any longer. It's cold outside. Yet, only a few months ago, it was not. Where does this end? April?
This is your Green News Report.
Thanks, Donald Trump.
Okay, Desi Doyen, we've been speaking about this past week or two, about this extraordinary situation in Iran, but as you note, it is not just Iran?
No, it is not, unfortunately. A new analysis from the World Meteorological Organization warns that across the volatile Middle East, critical climate risks are accelerating. The WMO report estimates nearly half a billion people in 22 countries across the Arabian Peninsula and North Africa face an array of intensifying climate impacts, from drought in one of the planet's already most water-stressed regions and from rising risks of extreme, unsurvivable heat, crop failure, and famine in years to come, increasing the risk of mass migration. The new study builds on previous research, finding that the Middle East and many other major regions of the world are drying out as man-made climate change disrupts the planet's water cycle. Here's ProPublica's climate reporter Abram Lustgarten on PBS NewsHour.
The rate of drying that they measured has quickly accelerated just over the last 10 years or so, since 2014. And so that's particularly alarming.
Yeah, it is alarming. And, you know, it kind of seems like if you were against mass migration, you'd want to work really, really hard to do something to mitigate climate change. But I guess the message hasn't gotten to Donald Trump.
Nope. In other news, a first ever detailed analysis examines the human costs of the Trump administration's denial of climate science and blockade of solutions. The Trump administration's massive rollbacks of U.S. climate and pollution regulations could lead to 1.3 million additional deaths globally from extreme heat in coming decades. That's according to a new analysis by ProPublica. Most of the people expected to suffer in these temperature-related deaths live in poor countries in Africa and South Asia that are least prepared to cope with the rising heat from climate change.
Well, we know Donald Trump ain't going to do nothing excited about that.
Here in the U.S., the Republican-controlled Congress gave another big gift to big oil late last week, repealing a Biden-era policy that restricted oil and gas drilling in the pristine Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, the latest reversal in the decades-long tug-of-war over the refuge. In related news, both of Alaska's Republican senators are pushing back against the Trump administration's new plan to expand offshore drilling in Alaska's waters over concerns that offshore drilling could hurt communities in the area that depend on fishing and whaling, and because the region doesn't have the infrastructure to clean up any spills.
So drilling on pristine lands is just fine for these two U.S. senators, but drilling in offshore pristine waters is... well, that's a bridge too far.
Yes.
Okay, that makes total sense.
In other news, activists in the expanded MAGA universe known as Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA, are targeting Trump EPA Chief Lee Zeldin. Prominent activists in the MAHA movement have launched a massive petition urging that Zeldin be fired over his decisions to loosen restrictions on harmful chemicals and his approvals of new pesticides containing forever chemicals, all at the request of the chemical industry. Solar energy developers are racing to get permits for proposed projects before the Trump administration ends deployment incentives established by the Biden administration on December 31st. At a time when electricity demand in the U.S. is skyrocketing due to the proliferation of energy-hungry data centers around the country. But there is a bit of good news. The U.S. has hit a new record for deployment of utility-scale solar, battery storage, and onshore wind capacity that has all come online since July, thanks to earlier projects getting completed across the country, proving once again that solar is the fastest, cheapest way to increase electricity generation in the United States and around the world.
Coming in just before the buzzer.
Yep.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Speaking of coming in just before the buzzer, we have got to get out. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Made possible by those of you who hit a donate button when you stop by. Thank you in advance. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog. Stop by and say hi. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.